This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Julia Wheeler and Julia Bradbury.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Hi. Thank you. It's the two Julias. That's pretty good. We like that.
We decided we're going to call ourselves Julia Squared.
Yes, that's right. And as this is the week that we're all talking about, women's equality and everything else, the same. We're doing it for the girls.
Thank you so much for being in here, squeezing in, and everybody at the back can hear us, yeah?
Yes, no, sorry, right. there weren't enough seats. You kind of foxed us there. You were looping round the stage, so we'll
welcome,
try and be entertaining.
Welcome to you to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Looking at that film and reading your CV, you'd kind of think that, and we know that you're never happier than being out there in the wild and muddy boots and camera crew in tow, but you didn't actually start in TV in this field, did you?
No, it was a strange way, actually, that I ended up doing all of this, the travel stuff, the outdoor stuff, the Country Files. I suppose the significant work before all of this was Country File, consumer journalism. That was, I started out actually in LA, but that's a long time. We'll go back, you know, that's going back 20-odd years. I was in LA doing all the Hollywood stuff, and I knew even then, when I was doing it in my late 20s, I knew that I couldn't do that forever, that it was a young person's game. And when I came back to the UK to live here, I ended up, after a circuitous route, I ended up on Watchdog, presenting Watchdog with Nikki Campbell, which I absolutely adored because it's television journalism, consumer journalism, rooting out stories, finding out who the bad guys are, and taking them to task over their naughtiness. So that was really a dream job for me. And I saw some programmes that were popping up on BBC4 that I really, really liked. They were very very different to Watchdog. There were some documentaries and just some interesting strands, and I found out who the commissioning editor was of those programmes, and I phoned up his office and said, can I come and have a coffee with him? And I went to have a coffee with this guy up in his little office in TV Towers. And he told me about this project that was coming up. He'd commissioned a series about Alfred Wainwright, the fell walker in the Lake District. And then we got talking about walking. And I explained that my passion started in Derbyshire with my dad. When I was at school at Sheffield, my dad would take me... There he is. Hello, Daddy. My dad would take me across the Peak District after school and at weekends and head me out there walking. And he turned it into such an adventure for me. I was about six, I think, when we first started going. And he told me stories. He taught me things about the natural world. He's incredibly bright and very engaging. He's a very good talker. So he really made it interesting for me, and we'd have competitions running up the hills and all of that stuff. So that was my childhood. And when, fast forward, we're having this conversation and I'm talking about this to this commissioner, he told me about the Alfred Wainwright series, and from there, it was sort of decided, wouldn't it be quite nice? And this, believe it or not, was a bit of a revelation that a woman should present it, because they had naturally been thinking about male presenters to follow in the footsteps. Alfred Wainwright, and that's how the Wainwright's Walk started on the BBC, and that's how all of this stuff started, because then after the Wainwright's Walks on BBC Four came Country File on BBC One.
Okay, so we'll come to Matt Baker in a second. Let's just talk about your dad, actually.
Okay.
And he's obviously been an inspiration to you. How important do you think it is to get people, in the words of Miss Jean Brodie, early, catch them young and get out there?
I think it's incredibly important. You're always going to have children who moan and groan about, oh, I don't want to go on another walk, and oh, it's boring. So it's our job as the parents, the guardians, the old ones, to make it interesting. It's also our job these days, I think, to embrace technology and try and use that as a tool to get them out there as well. So Pokemon Go, I don't know if there are any parents here, but Pokemon Go is a great way. It's like a treasure hunt for this stupid little animated character, but it's a really good way to get the kids interested. And geocaching, yeah, which is a treasure hunt idea as well. You get them to read a map or use a GPS machine, so you're engaging their brains, working out about geography and where we're going. And I know that for me, there was definitely a stage where I didn't care about the outdoors, and I did, you know, it wasn't at the forefront of my brain. But the memories have stuck with me, and that's what they say when you're bringing up children. And obviously, I'm a mother of three children now, and I remember this. It's about the memories that you create for your children. They might not necessarily remember all of the incidents and every single place that you were, but this sort of build-up of happy memories and the experiences is what's important, and that's what sticks sticks with you, and that's really what becomes part of your DNA as you get older.
Yeah, whether it's parents or grandparents, actually.
Parents, grandparents,
aunties, uncles.
I'm also an ambassador for the Scouts. Scouting is a really important movement. We need more young girls going into scouting. Need more volunteers as well for scouting, please, to become scout leaders. So yeah, there are lots of different outlets and ways to get the younger generation involved, and it's so important because they are the next David Attenboroughs and the next Mies or whoever is passionate about preserving our natural world.
So you and Matt Baker,
yeah,
quite the dynamic duo, really.
Well, lovely Matt Baker. I remember a phone call that I had to make to Matt Baker's wife before. It was just about the time that we started to work on Countryfile together, and his wife Nicola is absolutely lovely. And I went, "Hi Nicola, I'm really sorry, I'm going to have to sleep with your husband." And we'd been assigned to do this job for Children in Need together called Around the World in 80 Days. And they had celebrity pairs who were going off with a carpet bag. And it was a challenge where we had to pass the bag over to different people, raising money and awareness for children in need at the same time. And Matt and I were thrown together, and we basically had to share a train carriage, share bunks. We slept in a yurt in Mongolia together, along with 18 other people. We were really, really chucked in at the deep end, and we just became the firmest of friends. And we had, I think, one falling out along that whole trip where he was being very boyish and very macho and decided to take on a Mongolian wrestler. I don't know if anybody's ever seen Mongolian wrestling. They're enormous, as you would expect. And I got a bit sort of motherly and protective of him. And don't be stupid, you're going to get hurt. And he went, "I'll be fine, I'll be fine." He broke his nose in 2 minutes. It was bleeding and everything. I was like, "See, I told you so." But yeah, I mean, he's a lovely, lovely guy, and I'm so thrilled for him. You know, he works really, really hard and does the one show brilliantly. And the Countryfile for him is the show that he wants to die doing. He wants to be John Craven.
When you're on Countryfile, how much say did you have in the stories that you did? How, you know, in the production meetings and things? Did you throw things in, or were you kind of told, "Julia, this week, this is what you're going to do"?
Look, Countryfile is obviously, it's a big old machine, and there's a lot of planning that goes into the stories, but Matt and I certainly work in a particular way, and maybe that's why we get on so well. We've got opinions, and we've been doing it for a long time, so we generally say what we're going to say rather than what somebody else has written for us, and we get involved in the research. So you'll be given the stories and the locations, and then you sit down and you read through it, and you question the producer about what you're doing, why are we asking these questions, why aren't we talking to this person. So in our case, we are very, very self-sufficient, and we had argy-bargies with the producers sometimes about stuff that we disagreed with and everything else. So yes, I think for me the important thing in my job is that what I say on screen, there's got to be passion behind it and an authentic sound behind it, and I can only do that if I believe in what I'm saying.
One of the big things that you do believe in, and there are many,
yes,
is accessibility for all,
yes,
particularly in terms of walking.
Yeah, I really do. I think I've throughout the course of my career in all sorts of different programs, I've met a lot of people who have benefited from the outdoors and engagement with the outdoors and nature and trees and standing next to a mountain and working in the great outdoors, including drug addicts and alcoholics who've got involved in schemes with the National Trust, whereby they've been involved in volunteering, spending time outdoors, and it's really helped overcome their addictions and bring their thoughts into line. I work with a mental health research charity called MQ, which is all about researching mental health and the beginnings of mental health and how to combat it as well. And spending time in the outdoors really benefits mental health, our emotional and our mental well-being. And also, if you do have mobility issues, it's not fair or right that you shouldn't be able to still get out into the great outdoors. So the picture you see there is of on the left-hand side of the screen. That's the Outdoor Guide. That's a website that I've co-founded with my sister Gina Fox, and it's all about the great outdoors. It follows my travels and my walks and offers all of my walks for free to download and lots of information about the great outdoors. And we're really proud that we have a section called Access Tog, and the lady on the right there is the lovely Debbie, who is right here on the left-hand side of the stage. This is Debbie North, and Debbie wrote to me because, I'll tell her story quickly, and I'll probably get something wrong and she'll correct me, but Debbie was a teacher and she found out that she had a degenerative spine disease, which meant that her love of the outdoors might be stymied because she was going to become wheelchair bound, and she didn't let that stop her. She did the coast to coast when she was on 2 feet, and she also completed the completed the coast to coast when she was in a wheelchair. So round of applause for Debbie for doing that. And she wrote to me when she did that, and she said, Julia, will you... I didn't know her, but she said, look, I know you've done the Coast to Coast, because that went out on the BBC. Will you write the foreword for our book? Andy and I, my husband and I, have written a book. And I said, of course I will. And then we got into contact, and my sister Gina is one who does a lot of talking, and we all became friends. And now Debbie is our ambassador for Access Tog. And on Access Tog, you'll find a lot of wheelchair-friendly walks, which also means they're fairly... some of them are easier walks, but not all of them, because you can get to some good summits on wheels these days. And yeah, as I said, it's really important. And Debbie will tell us what it means to still be able to get... There's a microphone somewhere.
Yeah.
There you go. So how important is it, Debbie, for you still to be able to enjoy the great outdoors?
I think you can sum it up in one word, and it's freedom. I can still get out and enjoy the benefits of the outdoors, whether it be along a canal walk or whether it be up the top of the mountains and Blencathra, Skiddaw. For me, it's the freedom of being outdoors.
Lovely. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks very much, Debbie.
And we should say that the stand is just there, so if anybody wants to go and carry on that conversation afterwards, then you'll be there.
Yeah, don't all go together. It's only little, look. But you can
crowd in.
Make
crowd
it cute.
So we talked a little bit about England and the UK more generally, but international walks as well. You've had, I mean, just looking at that, your show reel, there's Germany, there's Australia. You've been to some, you know, pretty tasty places.
I'm very, very lucky. I mean, I used to present the Rough Guide travel series when I was doing Watchdog. I was doing that. So I was traveling around the world and then coming back for a live show on a Tuesday doing that. So yes, I've been around the globe a little bit. In terms of walking abroad, Germany is a beautiful location. And in fact, Debs has just come back from Bavaria, which is stunning. More castles in Bavaria than anywhere else in the world per square metre or foot or some statistic like that. It was the inspiration. There's a castle there. It was the inspiration for Walt Disney's famous castle as well. And I went there for a series called Wanderlust, where I did four different regions, Bavaria being one and Saxony, Switzerland being another, and the Baltic coastline. And the signage in... Let's just talk about the signage in Germany. As you would expect, superb, isn't it? Isn't it, Debs? Oh, they've turned you off.
I'm back again.
Yeah,
Germany are very proud and with good reason about promoting barrier-free. And that's what we went over to experience it for ourselves. And I was on top of mountains by cable cars, and we shed quite a few tears when I was there sharing that stunning view that everybody else was able to access. So, yeah, highly recommend Germany for their barrier-free.
And I think overall, I think walking in a country, whether you're doing it on your wheels or by foot, you do get, I think, a better sense of place when you're on 2 feet. You know, you really feel the soul of a country. I say you feel the soul of a country through the soles of your feet. I mean, I've done some walking safaris in South Africa. I love South Africa. It's a place I return to time and time again because I've got lots of mates over there. And, you know, walking, not being in a jeep, but actually walking through the bush with a guide, with a gun, it's a sensory overload. I mean, we ran into a rhino on one occasion, and you know, we were like, the guide was like, "Stop, stay still, don't move," you know, and he went like that, "Hide there," and we looked at this little twig on the ground and going, "What?" But again, you know, you feel this really palpable sense of where you are and what you're seeing. You see things differently when you're on foot as well. If you're in a car, you know, you're at a different level. So it is. I think it's the best way to explore a country, and I hope I've got lots of. I've never done South America. There are lots of places on the hit list that I still want to go to.
And when you've been out and about in the rest of the world, I mean, Brits are known, we love a good walk.
Yeah.
Which other nationalities kind of have that passion in the same way, do you think?
I think we're very, very unique. The Germans really do love a good walk as well, and you'll find a lot of lovely Germans in a lot of locations that you go to. But when you talk to, say, Americans about what we do, you know, 9 million of us go out walking every month. It is our national pastime, our most popular national pastime. Americans think we're crazy, you know, walking across farmland and all of this stuff. We're really, I think, unique. But what's great about social media is you make friends with lots of people. So saying that about the Americans, there's a group on Instagram called Women Who Hike, and we we've become friends on Instagram now, and they're amazing. And they've got, of course, America's got the national parks, the Yosemites, and all of those those great mountain ranges, and such a diverse number of landscapes. But it's big. So unlike here, where we can do quite a lot, you can, you know, you can cover this country, you can do it in a year. You can't do that in America. Yeah. So you tend to end up talking to a group from Ohio, and they might not move very far from Ohio, or even the Canadians, they stick within their range. But I think the fact that you can cover the UK fairly extensively, that's what makes it so unique. That's what makes us such good travellers and walkers.
You know that you're lucky and that you've got a privileged position. But I feel that you really take that responsibility quite seriously in terms of the things that you feel strongly about.
Yeah.
And one of those that I think lots of people are starting to feel strongly about, or well on the way to, is plastic.
Yes, I mean,
it's not a new crusade for you, is it?
It's not a new crusade for me. And I work with lots of associations who have been talking about plastic for a long, long time. Surfers Against Sewage. There's a great Twitter handle called 2 Minutes Beach Clean, which encourages us all just to go, if you're on a beach, clear up the plastic that you see, including the tiny bits of pellets that you'll find. Do it for 2 minutes. The Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society. And I'm an ambassador as well for Keep Britain Tidy. And in March, Keep Britain Tidy are doing a big push called the Great British Spring Clean, and they want you, they want us to get involved, and the Outdoor Guide is involved. There's Matt and I. We're giving out these bags for people to get involved and go and pick up litter and bits of trash, including plastic, that unfortunately we now find everywhere. Yes, it is unfortunately strangling our oceans, but it is also in our beautiful countryside as well. You find it on roadsides, you find it in hedges, you see it everywhere you go. And I think the big misnomer about plastic is people think that recycling is the answer. And recycling is a tiny, tiny part of the solution. So to bore you with a statistic, since plastic production began in the 1950s, more than 8 billion metric tons has been produced. And since that, only 9% of that has ever been recycled. The rest is still here on the planet, under our feet, in the oceans, or in landfill. Unless it's been incinerated, and that's 11% since the 1950s. And incineration has its own issues because it's polluting our skies with the toxic fumes that come out. So every bit of plastic that you use is potentially ending up in our oceans and on landfill. So all I say to people is, we can't get rid of plastic from our lives now. The problem is too big, and that's what governments all around the world are realising. It's too late. So we have to be the ones that make small changes in our lives. So I tell people, please get yourself a recyclable cup, and if you like teas and coffees, take one of these to your supplier rather than getting those cups that aren't recyclable. And anyway, recycling, as I said, is not the answer. Please look at your toothbrush. On average, we use 67 toothbrushes in our lifetime. They end up in landfill because they're really difficult to recycle because of the brushes and the plastic. Try a bamboo one. They're sustainable and they biodegrade. Don't accept straws in your local pub. Say no to plastic straws. Get them to get paper straws. You know,
or if you even need a straw.
Who needs a straw? Some people do. Some kids do, and it helps them. So use a paper straw. Back to the paper straws. And at the supermarkets, we've got to put the pressure on the supermarkets saying, no, we do not want our fruit and our veg in plastic trays wrapped in cling film. Thank you very much. We don't need it. Put it back in cardboard. Find other options. If we go back to the slide before, Eco for Life is a bottle that is made from plants. It's plant-based. It's a plant-based bottle, and it's biodegradable as well. And the water is sustainably sourced from springs around the UK. We work with Eco for Life on the Outdoor Guide. But it's up to us to make these small changes. And I can't go on enough about plastic and how it's polluting, and it's toxic as well. You know, it's not healthy for us in the long term, us as individuals.
I told you she cares. She does care. Let's talk about this book,
yes.
Which is available afterwards. Julia's going to be signing on the Stamford's stand just
I'll be
over there.
Signing these.
So this is Unforgettable Walks, Britain's Best Walks with a View.
Yeah, so this book went with my first series of walks that went out on ITV. And that was a couple of years ago. And you know, the other ones, we'll talk about those that have come since. So why this book is still a sort of it's a favourite and everything. I think this book condenses the story of me and how I got into walking. So you read about my dad in these books, you read about Matt Baker, you read about my encounter with Prince Charles on the 25th anniversary of Countryfile, you read about experiences with people like Chris Bonington there, Sir Chris Bonington, and also it's got the stories of some lovely walks, Dorset, the Cotswolds, Anglesey, which we saw on that film there, the Peak District, the Kinder Scout Walk being the beginning of walking.
Tell us about that.
So the Kinder Scout Mess Trespass was the moment, and I'm very bad with dates, but
1932.
There you go. Thank you very much. I was going to say 1930s, which are meant to be very precise. 1932. Basically, it was a tussle between workers and landowners, and the workers wanted the right to roam across the land and get the health benefits of the outdoors. And of course, the landowners didn't want these disgusting, nasty, grubby lot walking across their land. So they got into a fight with the gamekeepers and the heads of the estates. People were arrested and Benny Rothman was thrown into prison. But this movement was arguably the beginning of the national parks, which opened up national parks for all of us, and also was the beginning of access to roam, our freedom to walk across the countryside. So if you haven't been to Kinder Scout, it's a pretty monumental place to go to and to get to, and sort of you tap the top there and you're like, so this is the beginning of it all. Yeah. So it's a pretty cool place. Yeah. And that's where I used to go walking with my dad as well. So it's for
really
me, it's a full circle.
One of the other walks that's in there is the Burling Gap, which is that, I mean, it's just so iconic, isn't it, with those white cliffs.
The South
behind.
Downs Way and the Burling Gap is another of my favourites. Beautiful, beautiful walk. I've done it many, many times, and I've always been blessed with lovely weather. And yes, the Burling Gap is it's one of those ones that you have to do. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing that many times. I've done it with the Ramblers actually many, many times.
But it's not the only book, as we said, because there's also Britain's Best Walks. So there you are in Dorset.
There I am in Dorset. So we didn't do a book to go with the second series, but this second series, which went on ITV, a repeat of this walk. Who recognises where we are there? Yeah, Old Harry's Rocks in Dorset, the lovely Old Harry's Rocks. That went out again. A repeat of this episode went out on ITV a few Mondays ago. I don't know if you saw it, but lots of people did, because the series when it went out was very well loved and watched. But the repeat on the Monday got 3 million people watching it. So it just goes to show you that people really, the walks endure, because I think people really like to spend time with the scenery and enjoying the stories, you know, the folklore and the people along the way. That's what makes them so special.
And at this time of year, it just gives us hope, doesn't it? I mean, it's a glorious sunny day out there today.
That's what you want. You want inspiration, and you want to work out, where am I going to go this year?
Yeah, yes. Sit there and plan your next trip.
Yep.
And just this week, we've had the top 100.
So this was an incredible event for me, because for a mainstream channel to put walking on in prime time, which they've done with my walking series, we thought we'd done well with that, and of course that's fantastic. But on Tuesday night, ITV did 2.5 hours of back-to-back walks, which
did anybody see it? Oh, good. Well,
yes, well done. Well, millions of people watched it. Loads of people. It trended on Twitter for 4 hours. You know, it was a big deal for ITV, and I'm forever grateful for ITV for doing this, because I think they really listened to what people love and they did this. I know that there were some people who complained that the top 100 was too quick and it didn't give enough detail to all of these walks. Well, that's because it was a top 100 count, and it's hard. You can't give enough time. But I promise there'll be more, so we'll put the detail in the bigger series, in the different series. But I think this just cemented our passion as a nation for walking. And it was compelling as well to work out what was coming number one. 8,000 people took part in the survey.
And how did they vote?
So they voted through our friends who helped us with the voting were the Ramblers, National Trust and Ordnance Survey. So through those outlets, you guys got to vote, and 8,000 people did so. The vote could have gone on for longer, and we could have made it wider, and perhaps that would have changed the outcome. But we didn't have time, because we wanted to get it out now. We wanted, for the reason you just said, Julia, we wanted it to be out in the beginning of the year for people to be inspired. And I know people were telling me on social media, I'm watching along, I'm making notes of where I want to go, and I'm ticking off the ones I've done and the ones I've bagged. So it really got people talking, it really got people engaged. So yeah, it was a success.
And which were the regions that were the most popular?
So the regions, not surprisingly, that were most popular were Scotland, Wales and the Lake District. I think the Lake District got in the top 10, ended up with 6 of the walks or something. I mean, yes, it's unfair, really, because the Lake District is just blessed with so many beautiful walks. And of course, it's a bigger surface area. If you go to somewhere smaller, you know, if you go to Berkshire or Hertfordshire, they just haven't got the number of walks and the variety of walks that the Lake District has. But there were a lot from the Lake District. But of course, who knows what number one was?
Spoiler alert. Put your hands in your ears and look away from the screen.
Okay. It was Helvellyn. It's out there, we know. So Helvellyn got the number one spot, which I admit, and I admitted on the programme, to being quite surprised about, because it's a tough walk. Yes, I don't want to discourage people. I think anybody can get up to the top of Helvellyn. And actually, I wish I had one of my favourite pictures that I took was of a dad with his little toddler right up there. And it was a mum and dad, and they got their little boy up there. So you can get up Helvellyn, but it does take some planning, and that you need to work out the right route for you, and there are easier routes to do it. And when you get up there, the views are just immense and incredible and amazing. But yes, I think we were all a bit surprised that it was something quite as big as Helvellyn that got the number one. But Helvellyn's very proud. It has its own Twitter page and it's very happy.
I bet it is. And you were saying that if you're going to do it, maybe do it the first time in the summer.
Yes, I mean, health and safety warning. Mountain Rescue, which is another cause that I champion a lot. Mountain Rescue, for those of you who don't know, they're all volunteers. They all volunteer their time. A lot of them have Mountain Rescue dogs, which they train and live with and they love and adore. You know, it's not a hardship for them. But when that call comes in, they're ordinary folk pulled away from their ordinary lives to come and help us off the mountains. And all too often, unfortunately, they're helping people who just didn't take care going up the mountain or beginning their walk. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't have somebody with them who knew where they were going. They couldn't read a map, or they didn't have somebody with them who could read a map. They got lost. They didn't have the right gear. If you get lost, this is no word of a lie, if you get lost in bad weather up Helvellyn and you haven't got the right gear, you will die. You know, you can die. The hypothermia, the colder. So people now, if you've been inspired and this is when you are going to go do a Helvellyn, do it with somebody who's done it before. Take care, use the right kit, really, really know what you're doing because it's not the kind of route that you want to get lost on. And Mountain Rescue will do their best, but you know, they're humans as well. And if it's not safe for them, they can't get to you. Yeah. So yes, take care and thank you to Mountain Rescue teams everywhere for taking care of us.
So taking a slightly different direction with another new series.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So, I've done quite a lot in my career, as you've seen, and I don't like to get pigeonholed. And as much as I hope that I'm still walking when I'm 90 on the television, I do lots of other series which I enjoy. That's what you know I find rewarding about my job. So a new series coming up with the lovely Max McMurdo, who you might have seen on programmes like Amazing Spaces. Max is an incredible upcycling, recycling DIY guy, and the show is called My 10K Holiday Home. So if you thought you had to be a multimillionaire or a rich person to own your own holiday abroad, this show tries to bust that myth. I bought myself a holiday home in Portugal for £6,500.
And this is part of the show,
isn't it? And this is part of the show. And my challenge is to do it all up for £10,000 and, you know, end up with a finished home that I can be proud of. And I do it with the help of my friend Max. And along the way, it's a series of 6, and along the way, I meet up with people who have also done this challenge and have created rather lovely holiday homes on a tiny, tiny budget, which we hope makes this genre accessible to more people than ordinarily it would be. Look, we all love looking at people's lovely homes, and we all love looking at millionaires' homes and, you know, having a nose and a poke around. But I hope that this is going to inspire people. And I won't go into too much detail, but you do not need to be an expert in DIY, because you will meet people in this series who were not, and who taught themselves amazing things.
So can you just give us little snippets of the sort of thing, perhaps the place that you found, what it looked like when you found it?
So when I found my place, and I'm not going to say exactly where it was, it had been empty for 20 or 30 years. So you can imagine the state. I think the lady that lived in it died in the bed. And it's in a little village, very unspoilt, but the reason I said yes to doing it is I thought it would be possible to do it within the budget. Do things go wrong? Of course they do.
Well, that's telly.
That's
it's
telly.
Got to.
And it's building. You know, yeah. If anybody's taken on their own building challenge, stuff happens. Things are not what they seem.
And is it actually big enough for your family?
It's just about big enough.
Squidged in.
Yeah, but caravans are quite big as well. Remember that.
Yeah. Okay, great. So let's get the microphones out, because I'm sure there are questions out there. Do stick your hand up if you've got a question for Julia, and we'll get a microphone to you.
I wanted to ask, what are the top three things you'd pack for a walk?
Top three things I'd pack for a walk. So I've been asked quite a lot what my favourite snack is on a walk. And I'm not very good in the mornings. So what I tend to do is the B&B or the hotel that we're staying at if we're filming, I ask them to make me a crispy bacon sandwich on brown with tomato ketchup. I wrap it and I take it with me because I don't like to eat too early. And about 10 or 11 o'clock when I'm starving, when we've been filming for a while, that's when I eat my cold crispy bacon sandwich.
Lovely.
So that's got to be number one, with a chocolate bar. I'll include those as a joint number one. I take multiple layers of clothing. I really feel the cold. That was really cold. It looks like a gorgeous day. We filmed in October up Helvellyn. It was good. I mean, we were so lucky that we actually had sunshine, but it was still freezing up there. You know, you're 3,000 metres up, and it was cold. So I have got very many layers on, and I always pack lots of layers with me so that I can... I'm obviously hot when I start walking and cold as soon as I'm filming a piece to camera. So I've got the layers with me, and always waterproofs, just for that moment when it starts raining. And then... what else have I always got with me? Apart from water, which will be in one of these. Thank you very much, Stanford's, for this reusable one as well. It will always be a reusable cup. Let's see, is there anything fun that I've always got there? I've always got a pen with me. I'm a journalist, so I'll always have a pen and a notepad to make some notes of something. I forget people's names quite quickly. Yours is easy. So it's always good to write down things along the way. So, yeah.
Okay. Good top tips.
Good top tips.
Questions out there, pop up your hands. Now's your chance.
There's
one just here.
Look, we got a victim.
Look at that man run.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
How do you feel about the Tony Robinson walks? Do you see those as good or a challenge to you? Or
look, I think it's great. I mean, I think the Tony Robinson walks on Channel 4, it's good. I mean, I'm flattered because everyone says, you know, I started this walking movement. It's brilliant. I think, you know, the more walks that we see, the great. And I like the fact that I'm not Tony Robinson.
And he can't say the same about you.
No, he's I'd say he's more typical of the man you see on television doing that kind of programming, which is fine. That's good. I'm not so typical, I hope. Yeah. And that's what I like about it.
Good. There's a question at the back there.
We'll turn you on. Oh, there's a range. Who
there
knew?
Is a range.
Hello.
Good afternoon. You said you were surprised that Helvellyn got to the number one spot on the 100 greatest walks. What were you expecting to be number one, two and three?
I just thought... I wasn't surprised that the Lake District was one of those, but I thought maybe something a little bit smaller, maybe a Cat Bells as well, that's more popular for an entire group of families. I think mountaineers amongst us will say that Helvellyn is a proper mountaineer's mountain. So maybe a more family-friendly or... a slightly more accessible one of those. I mean, I'd have put Castle Crag, but it's too small and it doesn't really count as a mountain or anything in the Lake District. Or, of course, it would have been something in Derbyshire for me. I hope that answers the question.
I think the thing is that everybody's got their own favourite, haven't they? For whatever reason, childhood or...
Yeah, and everybody has a view and every, you know, there are lots of people who go, yes, it should be Helvellyn, it should be a mountain, it should be, you know, that's what it's like. It's like football when you're watching football. Everybody knows what the formation the team should be playing in. Yeah. Same with walks of mountains. Theirs is the favourite for very good reasons. Yeah.
Other hands.
More hands. Here we go.
Down here. We're making you work, Roddy.
Think about it, people. Have a little think.
What, if anything, have you lost on a walk?
Oh, gosh, I've lost lots of things. I'm the world's sort of worst. I've got lost, for a start. Here I am saying, do the map reading. I'm one of those people that takes a really good map reader with me. I think I was out with my sister Gina once, actually, and she fell down, and she just had quite a nasty fall. And as she fell, she broke the fall like that, and she lost the bracelet that we kept looking for afterwards. Aww. So that was something sad that we always talk about that we've lost. I think I've left fleeces in places that I shouldn't have done as well. You know, you taking off a layer, as I often do, and maybe one goes by there by the backpack and the other one goes, and I kind of like then put the backpack on. I haven't lost anything major, I'm delighted to say. And I haven't lost a person, is good. That's good news. What have you lost?
On Boxing Day, car key.
Oh, no, the car keys. He said lost the car keys.
And a week later, found them.
You did not. You found that at the same place, on the path. In the mud. So you retraced your footsteps and refound them in the mud.
It was somewhere where I knew I'd been, if you see
what I mean. Where you'd been. I know what you mean. I've been quite a few of those places as well. If you walk a lot, you have to been in those places. Yeah.
Question at the back there.
Can you hear me?
Hello, yes, we've got you. You're in range. That's good.
On a typical walk that you've had on the telly.
Yes.
Railway walks or the ordinary walks. How long does it actually take you to film it?
So that's a good question. How long does it take to film the television walks? It generally takes 2 or 3 days. Filming television is a dark art, as you know, Julia. You often film things out of sequence. You often film things because of people's availability. And you often film things because of the weather. So, for example, on a walk, if we know we've got a 3-day filming window, and we know that we've got better weather on the first day, we might film the end of the walk, the view, the finale, we might film that on the first day and the preamble up to that end section. So that might mean we might get to that part using vehicles, like National Trust are great and help us out, the Forest Rangers help us out as well, because we've got to get there to film the next 4 hours of stuff, and we've got to get there in the sunshine, or at least when we know it's not raining. So that might be when vehicles are involved. We don't ever use helicopters, which people think. A lot of people say, are you helicoptered from one place to the other? No, we don't do that. And we walk down the route. When we're at the top, we walk down. We can't cheat that one. As well, if we're interviewing a contributor, so somebody who is telling us a story about the walk that they've done, or they've done it 100 times, or a long-distance runner who did it in a record time, as happened in Cumbria with High Cup Nick, the lovely Mike, he was only available for half a day on a certain day of our filming window, so we had to do him first. Mm. So that's how the filming schedule works. It's backwards. And I know people sometimes like tweet, they go, "That Julia Bradbury, she doesn't do any walking. I saw her in a car, I saw her in a Ranger, I saw her, you know, going up." Well, that's why, I'm explaining why. But, you know, we do walk and we take the kit with us. And I think we did a hike across Iceland, and we walked 17K in one day, and that's the cameraman with his kit and all of our stuff. So, you know, we can all walk, and we all do walk, and we do all the hiking, but the difference being we're making a television programme at the same time. So sometimes on certain days we have to do the shortcuts to make it work. So yeah, about 2 or 3 days. And then the whole process of getting that walk on air takes months and months and months. There's research before that, setting up the interviews before that, then you go into the edit afterwards, then you've got to put the music down, then you've got to do the voiceover, then a big fat controller from the channel comes in and goes, change that. So it takes months to make one walk happen.
Was there a question over here? Yes, the gentleman here in the blue.
Here he goes.
We'll come to you in a second, sir, but fine.
Thank you. Have you ever walked across Helvellyn or a long striding edge in midwinter?
Yes, I have done that. Thank you for the question. If you follow me on Instagram or on Twitter, then I popped up a picture yesterday about another occasion where I had walked up Helvellyn, and I did striding edge, and we had a guide with us. We were filming David, our mountain goat, we used to nickname him. And it was miserable weather. It was soaking wet. It was raining. I got soaked through. and didn't have very good gear, actually, that particular day, because it got through, and had to do striding edge in mist and fog. It was slippery, it was wet, it was horrible, and it was quite petrifying as well, doing striding edge. You can't see it in that picture, but doing it in those conditions. And I don't recommend it. I definitely don't recommend it. But some people have said that they prefer to do it in weather like that, because you can't see down the edge. You can't see down the side. You don't know how steep it is. So, horses for courses.
Yeah. There's a question just here.
Hello, Julia.
Hello.
I particularly enjoyed your travel programmes, but particularly the ones on aviation. Do you remember your trip in a microlight out towards Banbury?
I do, actually. I was lucky enough to do... when I did Countryfile, we did quite a lot of... what are the arm... Basically, it's an armchair with a propeller on the back of it.
Microlight.
Huh?
I'm just going to say I followed your example and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, what was it? I've lost the name.
Microlighting.
Yeah. Microlighting. Bizarre sport. People do it. I mean, I've done it about four times. I think that's probably enough in a lifetime. It's quite hairy. It is just basically a seat with what looks like an office fan behind you. And then it takes off and you get incredible views. And yes, I did Banbury and across Oxfordshire. I also microlighted over the Victoria Falls. Mm-hmm. And could see over into Zimbabwe, and that was petrifying and fascinating at the same time. Those kinds of experiences are once in a lifetime experiences, and really you do see a different view.
Did you love it?
I did. Thank you very much.
So did it inspire you? Did you do it after that?
I followed your example.
It's great. Well done. Brilliant. Well, that's great. What we like. That's what we like. And that's what 100 Walks have done. People were tweeting all night saying, I've been inspired. I love our country. I'm going to go and do it. And that's wonderful. And I know that in the travel industry here, I know that a lot of the tourist boards and, you know, those kinds of places, and I know that we on the Outdoor Guide, 10,000 people looked at our website on that particular night. So it's great that people transfer what they see, they actually transfer it into real life experiences for them.
Thank you.
Has there ever been anything that you've been asked to do for telly or any other time that you've thought, actually, no?
I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. Yeah, those kinds of things. I'm not really into that kind of telly, and I know it's very, very popular. But that, to me, the challenges are different to the kind of challenges that I'm used to. Mm. And the challenges that, you know, what you saw at the beginning of the film, where I took on rock climbing for the first time and I got to the top of a sea stack, that's a real challenge for me. I'd never rock climbed. To get up an 80-foot sea stack when you've never done it before, and to really overcome a fear and to do that, I think that was a challenge. And I learned a lot about our mental capacity doing that. Mm. Eating animal parts and sitting there talking a lot of rubbish doesn't seem much of a challenge for me. I can do that at home. I just haven't eaten kangaroo bits.
Final question, yeah.
Hi, Julia. Have your children taken to walking?
So my twin girls are 2.5, they're 3. They're a little bit... They're a wee bit small, but my little boy... That being said, that we get them outside for an hour every day, whatever, and we've got a garden where they're out there and they're getting muddy and they're getting dirty, so we're starting that bit early. My little boy and I camped together for the first time in the garden last year, just to get him into the whole experience, which, of course, he absolutely loved it. And he's watched me, and he watches me on YouTube and stuff, and he's seen me doing the Iceland walk, actually. He's obsessed now with volcanoes, and we took him to Tenerife this year so he could walk up Mount Tidi, the volcano there, and he loved that. And now he wants to go and do Eyjafjallajökull, which is the big E.
Can he say it?
Eyjafjallajökull. He can say it. He had to do a school talk, and I taught him how to say it, and he talks about it all the time now. And the school were well impressed. yes, of course. They're and I'm going to Norway, actually. I'm doing some work in Norway this year, chasing the Northern Light, and he's coming with me to do that as well. So, they're going to get the outdoor bug for sure. And I wouldn't be surprised if he does something in telly, my little one. He's obsessed with filming and talking about stuff, so he might end up in this world.
Fantastic. We will have to leave it there, but I think, like any good walk, we ought to end with something in the pub.
Yes.
How important is a good pub at the end of the walk?
Oh, well, of the when this survey for the top 100 walks on ITV started going out, the most popular answer by far for me was the best walk is the walk to the end of my road to the pub. And absolutely, I think, you know, walks are an incredibly important part of any... pubs are an incredibly important part of any walk. So when you go onto the Outdoor Guide and you look at the routes and the walks that we've got on there, there's always a pub, there's always a B&B, and there's always a campsite. So I think those three things are essential for good walking terrain. And, my sign-off is I'll meet you in the pub.
Fantastic. Well, not today, because they're going to meet you in Stamford.
Yes, in Stamford, I will be book signing and do some selfies for you. And try not, if there's a big queue, try not... of course, I'll have a little chat to you, but remember there's somebody behind you as well. So we'll make it... we'll be speedy, but nice.
Yes, speedy, but nice. We like that. Nice. Thanks so much for coming. Thank you, Julia Bradbury.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming.